Side 4. The Legend of Luke by Brian Jakes. Continuing on page 133. All around the dune hog shelter, creatures sprawled, snoring, murmuring, some even chuckling or singing broken snatches of song in their sleep. For some reason, unknown to himself, a great weight lay on him, and tears sprang unbidden to his eyes. Then the warrior realized what the cause of his distress was. He had been laughing, singing, drinking, eating, and dancing, with hardly a thought for them. Them, being the father and mother, he could hardly remember, who had lived only 4 days away from the place where he now sat. A vision of a ship sailing off into a snow-swept day sprang into his mind, a memory of overwhelming sadness and pain. He gripped his sword tightly, knowing it was the only link between himself and the small young mouse who stood on the shore watching the ship vanish into swirling snow and heaving waves. Weariness overtook Martin of Redwall. He lay down and let his eyes close. The small mouse, the ship, and that long-ago day grew dimmer and dimmer, then vanished into the realms of merciful, dreamless sleep. 15. Over the following days and nights, Martin hardly rested or ate. He was unusually silent, and spoke only when he had to. Draped in a blanket and sailcloth, he sat at the prow of the Honeysuckle, regardless of the hostile weather, which grew colder by the day. Doonspike and his tribe had given them a marvelous send-off, plying the crew with stores of food and delicacies. Trimp and the others had been sorry to sail off. The hedgehogs were so hospitable and funny. Martin's somber mood affected the crew of the Honeysuckle deeply, and they were not the jolly bunch of companions who had traveled downstream together. Log-a-log Firmo cooked a special damson crumble, with Trimp assisting two of his guasum shrews to make tempting arrowroot and red currant sauce for it. They sat beneath the stern shelter while Gonf dished it up to the crew, filling each bowl brimful and remarking, "Dig in, mateys! This'll put the roses in your cheeks and a smile on your faces. Best skilly and duff I ever saw." Firmo raised his ladle warningly. "Ahoy, Gonfo! I'll raise a good lump twixt your ears if and I hear ye calling my best damson crumble and Miss Trimp's sauce skilly and duff. Humph! Skilly and duff, indeed. What does he think we are, missy, a pack of sea vermin?" Trimp held out a bowl to Gonf. "Fill it up, friend. I better take some to Martin. He only had a beaker of mint tea for breakfast, and 'tis late noon now, and he hasn't had a thing since." Gonf heaped a good portion into the bowl. "Best let me take it, Prettyin. I know him better'n any beast, except my Columbine. Wish she was here now. Little Gonflet, too. They'd cheer him up." Denny's homely face creased in a smile. "I'm thinking he infant and your pretty wife would cheer you up gooder'n any beast, Sir Gonfin." Gonf sat down. Putting the bowl to one side, he wiped at his eyes with a piece of rag. "That's the truth, Din. I miss Columbine and the little feller a lot. I ain't the cheerful roving type I used to be."
Chugger leaped onto the mouse thief's lap and hugged him.
"Shush now, Mr. Gonf. I be your little one, eh?"
The mouse thief could not help smiling through his tears.
"Bless your heart, Chug. Course you will. I hope you ain't a doonog no more. They're too prickly to hug. Beggin' your pardon, Miss Trimp. No reflection on you."
Martin came striding astern. He threw off the blanket and sailcloth, nodding to Firmo.
"Tell your shrews to trim the sail and take up oars. I can see the rock point standing out in the distance."
Firmo went up the mast like a squirrel. He peered ahead at the dark, jutting line far off, then came back down.
"Aye, that'll be the start of the Northlands, right enough. Fulgrim, will you take the tiller and keep her dead ahead? Gonf, help tie off the lines. We'll make landfall tonight if and she holds a tight sail. Stir your stumps, Guasum. Show our friends what a shrew rower looks like."
The Honeysuckle sprang forward,
only having to tack the slightest bit, running before a wind out of the southeast. Martin took the forward port oar, with Gonf plying the opposite one. The warrior set a vigorous pace, though Trimp cautioned him, "Easy now, Martin, not so fast. Think of the others." Gonf blew off spray that was tickling his nose.
"That's the stuff, Trimp. You tell him. Otherwise we'll all be flat on the deck afore we're halfway there. Don't forget, it's not safe to row like a mad beast on a full stomach as Skilly and Duff." "Ouch!"
The Gwasim rowers chortled gruffly as Firmo stood over Gonf, armed with his stout wooden ladle.
"I told you what I'd do, you insulting rascal. Now say after me, dense and crumble with good hot sauce."
Gonf repeated it dutifully, and Firmo made him say it again. The phrase made such a good rowing chant that the Gwasim shrews took it up, bending and straightening their backs in time to the cadence.
"Dense and crumble and good hot sauce. Dense and crumble and good hot sauce."
Chugger was acting captain again. He strode officiously up to Gonf and nodded approvingly.
"Mr. Gonf, you like a damser crumb and good hot sauces?"
The mouse thief licked his lips appreciatively.
"I certainly do, me little mate."
Patting his tiny stomach, Chugger growled fiercely.
"Well, you can't have it no more. I eat it all up, and I nut your little mate now. I Cap'n Chug, see?"
Not stopping for anything, they rode doggedly on, trying to keep up the pace, which Martin had unconsciously increased again. Midnight had gone by an hour when they rounded the point. Every beast lay back, panting with exhaustion, as Firmo gave orders to ship oars. Every beast except Martin. As the Honeysuckle's hull scraped to a halt in the shallows, he was upright, staring at the deserted shore, which was bathed in pale moonlight. Like lonely sentinels, the cliffs stood high in the background, topped by sparse vegetation. Darkened caves, partially covered by weather-warped driftwood and rubble, which had once disguised them from hostile eyes, lay forlorn and abandoned. A flood tide of memories poured in on Martin's senses. Every rock, even the wind-driven sand drifts, looked familiar to him. Turning to his tired companions, the warrior spoke in a hoarse whisper.
"I was born here. I know this place."
Slipping overboard, he waded through the shallows. Drawing his rapier, Logalog Firmo signaled to his Gwasim. Fulgrim picked up his axe, determined to go ashore with them. Gonf backed to the rail and stood in their path, holding up both paws.
"No, mates. Let our friend go alone. 'Twould not be right to intrude on him this night."
The crew of the Honeysuckle laid aside their weapons and sat down to await Martin's return. Striding slowly up the beach, Martin turned to his right, the cave which had once been his home drawing him to it like a magnet. At first he thought his eyes were deceiving him. Halting, he stared hard at the feeble glow emanating from the cave. It was a light. Some beast had lit a fire there recently, which had died to glowing embers. Drawing his sword, the warrior of Redwall crouched, moving forward, silent as moon shadow. Entering the cave, he flattened himself against the rock wall, waiting until his eyes were accustomed to the dim light. Covered by a long traveling cloak, an old mouse sat dozing by what was left of the fire. Martin crept close, extended his blade, and tapped the mouse's paw lightly with its point. He did this once again. Then the creature stirred, turning its face to him. The old mouse spoke in an awestruck voice.
"Ook, is that you?"
Wordlessly, Martin placed some broken twigs on the fire. Laying aside his sword, he sat down opposite the ancient creature, staring at it through the rising flames. A slow smile of pure joy stole across the old one's lined face.
"Oh, Luke! Luke, it is you! But how?"
The warrior spoke softly, so as not to frighten the old fellow.
"I'm Martin of Redwall, son of Luke the Warrior. Pray, what is your name, sir?"
Rising slowly, the old mouse shuffled around the fire. Sitting next to Martin, he reached out and touched the warrior's face.
Martin watched in silence as tears rolled down the mouse's cheeks and his head began to shake.
Ah, so many seasons, so long ago. I've returned here through snow, rain, and sun many, many times, and sat waiting alone, always alone.
Tears overcame further speech. Martin drew the old mouse to him, placing a paw about his scrawny back and wiping away the tears with the cloak hem. He rocked him gently.
There, there. No need to weep further, friend. I am Luke's son, and I have come. You are not alone.
The old mouse's eyes searched Martin's face.
Aye, you are Martin. So like your father, so like him. Do you not remember me? I'm Verg. I was Luke's best friend.
Martin could not remember him, but he nodded. Of course. I didn't recognize you in the dark. Verg, my father's strong right paw. I recall you now. How are you, Verg?
Holding forth his withered paws, Verg chuckled.
How am I? I'm old, Martin. Old, old, old. Hee-hee-hee! I've got more seasons on me than a hedgehog has spikes.
Martin hugged the scrawny form to him fondly.
Nonsense. I think you look just the same as you always did. I'll wager your appetite's still as good. Are you hungry, Verg?
Hee-hee! Any beast tough enough to be living on the Northland's coast is always in need of good victuals.
Martin sheathed the sword across his shoulder.
Right. Come on back to the boat with me. I've got a crew of guwassome shrews there who'll feed you till you burst.
Verg rose creakily, retrieving a beaded linen bag from the sand. This he stowed beneath his cloak.
Well, young Martin, what are we standing round here waiting for? Lead me to the grub.
Together they crossed the shore, Verg leaning heavily on Martin's paw for support, chattering away.
Guwassome shrew cooks, eh? Bet they know how to serve up proper-made victuals. Not like old Cardo. Now there was a mouse who'd burn a salad. Cook? Cardo couldn't boil water to save his life. You remember Cardo, don't you?
Martin lied as he kept the oldster on a steady course.
Oh, Cardo! How could any beast forget that buffoon?
Gaunt was on watch, sitting in the prow. He saw the two mice approaching the honeysuckle and roused the crew from their slumbers.
Ahoy, mates! Martin's coming back! Looks like he's brought company, too. Stand by, he might need help.
Fermo and Fulgrim assisted in getting Verg aboard. The old mouse winked at the scarred otter.
Hee-hee! Bet you could take care of yourself in a scrap!
Fulgrim's pointed teeth bared in a savage grin.
I've taken care of a few in me time, sir.
Verg mused absently as they seated him comfortably under the stern awning.
Aye, so did Luke and Rangavar. They took care of more'n a few. Hee hee.
Fermo patted the old one's paw fondly.
How's your sweet tooth, Granddad?
I tell you, young whipsnout, a sweet tooth's about the only one I got left in me mouth. Hee hee.
The shrew stoked up his stove with sea coal and driftwood.
Then how does a baked river roll with hot maple syrup sound to ye? I mix it with sweet flour and all over it. Got a beaker or two of dune hog seafoam ale to go with it. Sound good?
Verg wiped a paw across his lips.
I'll tell ye when me mouth quits waterin', young'un.
Morning came with overcast skies and a bitter wind. Martin sat beneath the stern shelter with his friends, sipping barley and carrot broth. Verg lay behind them, close to the oven, wrapped snugly in his cloak, sleeping off the feast he had consumed. Gaunt sat Chugger on his lap, allowing him to steal his beaker of broth.
You finish that all up, matey, and don't be dashing about kicking up a rumpus. Old Verg needs lots of sleep. Well, Martin, did you find out what you needed to know from the old feller? About your dad and so on?
Martin shook his head as he watched Verg sleeping.
Didn't want to rush him. Verg will tell me when he's ready.
though I did hint that I needed information. Then he looked over the top of his beaker.
What did him old feller say about that, sir?
Martin shrugged.
Not much, though he did say I'd find out all I needed to know when we took him back home to some place called Tall Rocks.
Chugger was beginning to wriggle out of Gonf's grasp. Trent took charge of him, stroking the tiny squirrel's head soothingly. She looked inquiringly at Martin.
Tall Rocks? Where's that?
The warrior stared out at the gray, wintry seas.
Somewhere up north of here. Verg said he'd show us the way.
Fermo picked up the linen bag from where it had fallen out of Verg's cloak and passed it to Martin.
What do you suppose is in this?
Martin sighed deeply and placed the bag carefully back in the folds of Verg's cloak without disturbing him.
He'll tell us when he's ready, I suppose. Though I'm not certain I want to know now. I have a feeling inside that 'tis going to be a long and tragic tale.
Verg woke before noon, feeling much refreshed, and to prove it, he ate a huge breakfast. Under his directions, they pushed off and continued north. Martin watched, silent and pensive once more, as his birthplace faded into the distance. 16. It was a late noon, 2 days out from Martin's former home, when Tall Rocks hove into view. Rain was falling heavily, and the wind had died completely. The sea surface, though pitted constantly by rainfall, was relatively calm, with a notable absence of the huge foam-crested rollers usual in the area. Verg stood in the bows, Martin at his side, and relayed directions. Fermo and Denny held the tiller between them, listening out for instructions.
"Keep her head out to sea a bit. Stick to that course."
Fermo obeyed, but voiced his doubts.
"Wouldn't we be better tacking in closer to the land side?"
Martin swiftly gave him his answer.
"No, no, stay seaward. Verg says the underwater reefs are close to the surface inshore. Out here the sea runs very deep, so the reefs are far below us. Keep her head out." "Right enough. Just as well the tide's running smooth today."
Martin agreed.
"Aye. Verg says that if any waves start up, you must steer right out to sea, away from Tall Rocks, and forget the whole thing until ebb tides arrive. Otherwise, the honeysuckle would be smashed against the rocks."
Denny glanced fearfully to the horizon.
"Oh, seas, keep ye girt waves clear of us'uns. There be nothing worser'n a drowned mole beast, no sir."
Trimp and the remainder of the crew stood aghast at the size of Tall Rocks. Monumental pillars of stone, they reared out of the sea like monsters from the dawn of time, huge and forbidding. For leagues of the coastline, the seas were dotted with them, colossal and weirdly shaped, some cylindrical, others triangular or square-sided, their bases festooned with seaweed, kelp, and dark moss above the columns of dark basalt stone. The honeysuckle's sail was taken in, and the most expert Guasum oar beasts sat at the rowlocks, knowing their lives depended on the accuracy and sureness of their strokes. The order came when they were almost abreast of a cluster of columns, fronted by one half as big again in girth and height as the rest.
"Take her in steady! Keep the biggin' on your port side!"
Trimp held tight to Fulgrim's paw.
"Good grief! Look at the size of those rocks, Fulgrim!"
Chugger, who had climbed onto the otter's shoulders, clung there like a leech, whimpering,
"I frightened, Mr. Fool! Chug no like this!"
Fulgrim tickled the little squirrel's footpaw.
"Aye, I'm frightened too, matey. So is the whole crew, and even Martin. So we're in good company, I reckons."
All else was forgotten as the monstrous pinnacles loomed close. Fear echoed in Fermo's high-pitched yell,
"Bring her round! Round the big rock! Push her off and take her round, mates, now!"
Rising in a smooth, high swell, the sea swept the skiff like a cork, straight for the big rock. Paddlers on one side banked her, rowing furiously, while Martin and Gonf joined the others,
fending the rock off by pushing against it with oars and long poles. With an audible sucking and gurgling, the swell receded. Down they shot into a deep trough, with the honeysuckle swerving bravely in a swift arc around the basalt monolith. No sooner were they on the lee side of the rock than the peril of their position increased. Now they were in a narrow channel betwixt the main column and the others grouped behind it. Obeying Verg's orders, the Guasim chieftain sang out, "I'm staring for that pack of rocks! Make ready to tie up forward, aft, and amidships. But don't tie her fast, mates. Leave slack so she can ride the swells." The moment they were in reach of the grouped pinnacles, Martin whirled a weighted line, as did Fulgrim in the midships, and Gonf at the prow. Again, the swell lifted them, and Fermo shouted, "Heave those lines out, mates!" The strong, slender ropes snaked out and up. Three iron grapnels clanked simultaneously into the stone crevices. The honeysuckle was secured safely, and bobbed up and down alongside the rocks, with the slack lines allowing her to ride easily on the swells. Log a log, Fermo could not stop his paws shaking. He wobbled along the deck and leaned against Martin, pale, breathless, and shaken. "By the fur and blood of the great Guasim, at least 10 times there I thought we was a goner, matey." Martin grasped his friend's paws, steadying them. "You did it superbly, Fermo. No beast could keep her on course like you did. 'Twas nothing short of a miracle." Stamping his foot paw against the deck, Fermo smiled proudly. "Aye, and no other craft in all the rivers and seas could have done it like our honeysuckle. What a ship! I'll tell some stories about her to my tribe when we gets back." Verg took a deep breath. Cupping paws around his mouth, he called out in a quavery voice,
"Ahoy the ARF ship! Ahoy there! Can you hear me?"
There was no answer. Fermo felt recovered enough to roar out in a thunderous baritone,
"Ahoy, ARF ship! 'Tis Verg and some company! Ahoy!"
Martin pulled the shrew to one side just in time to avoid a hefty rope ladder with timber rungs which came down out of the rocks and clattered to the deck. Gaunt stared in puzzlement at Verg.
"Who are we shouting to? And what's an ARF ship, mate?"
On the ledge above them, a hare appeared. He looked as ancient as Verg, older in fact. Shaking a tremulous paw at Verg, he called down,
"Where in the name of my auntie's apron have you been, what? I've been sitting up here like a blinkin' sickly seagull, worrying about you, sir. Now you come sailing up here pretty as you please, in charge of this jolly old rat's regatta. What?"
Verg mounted the rope ladder with Trimp's assistance, followed swiftly by her friends. The old mouse argued with the hare as he climbed up to the ledge.
"Oh, give your flapping jaws a rest, Bo. These creatures are friends. They brought me back from the North Shore, which is more'n I can say for you. I'd grow whiskers to me footpaws waiting on you to come and fetch me, you great flop-eared, bag-bellied, droopy-pawed rock rabbit."
The old hare's ears stood up indignantly as he helped Verg onto the ledge.
"Ha! Rock rabbit, is it? You bladder-bottomed old dodderer, what? I've had a barnacle casserole bubbling here for 2 confounded days waiting for you. Bad form, sir. I was going to make a plum pudding, too, but I flippin' well ain't now. So you can go and jolly well whistle for your blinkin' dessert for all I care, and I hope that casserole keeps you awake all night. Ungrateful bounder!"
Martin popped his head over the ledge. "When you two creatures have stopped arguing, would you mind moving aside? We've got a ship's crew to get up this ladder." The hare fitted a rock crystal monocle into one eye and glared down at Martin.
"Oh, have you now? Well, my compliments to you, sir, and your crew, what? I suppose you've come to eat us out of house and home without a by your leave or jolly old toodle pip."
Verg interrupted the hare's tirade.
"Ahoy, Bo! Mind your manners. Take a close look at yon mouse and tell me who you think he is."
Bo crouched down, holding his back and grimacing. He brought his face level with Martin's. The eyeglass popped out with surprise as he stared at the warrior mouse.
"Luke! Well, burn my auntie's taters, what? You're a bounder, a rotter and a curmudgeon, sir. How is it that you've stayed so jolly young while we've grown old? Not the done sort of thing, I'd say. Bally cad.
Martin sprang up onto the ledge. Smiling, he grasped Beau's paw and pumped it up and down.
I'm Martin of Redwall, son of Luke the Warrior. Whom have I the pleasure of addressing, sir?
The hare shook his hoary silver head, returning the smile.
Knew your father well, sir. Excellent chap. I'm Beau Hare Featheringham Cosfording Soul. No, I ain't. I'm Beau Soul Featheringhair Cosfording Clare. No, I ain't. Wait a tick. I'm Boham Feathering Clear Confound It All. Cha! I'm so old I've forgotten me own name. What a disgrace, what?
Berg sniggered.
Hee hee! Try Beauclair Feathering Soul Cosfordingham. That's your silly long name.
The hare scratched his scraggly whiskers.
Ah! Of course it is. Thank you, old chap.
Then, scratching his whiskers again, he turned on Berg.
On the other paw? Who asked you, sir? You battered old mouse relic? When I need some beast to tell me my name, I'll jolly well ask myself. Pish tush! The very idea. Telling a chap his own moniker.
Berg approached him until they stood nose to nose.
Battered old mouse relic? Well, of course I am. And who wouldn't be? Looking after you all these seasons? Should have left you on Twin Islands. That's what I should have done.
Martin clapped a paw to his brow, looking beseechingly to Gonf. The mouse thief pushed Beau and Berg apart.
Quiet now, you two, and listen to me. Aboard our ship we got a way of settling arguments. We let any quarrelsome beast settle things by challenging our argument counselor. Fulgrim, come over here.
Testing his axe edge by licking it, Fulgrim strode over. Bearing pointed teeth, he turned his scarred face from Berg to Beau. The otter's voice sounded like a blade hacking ice.
Well now, any beast got an argument to settle with me? Choose your weapons, axes or teeth. It don't make nods to me.
Berg immediately hid behind Beau, whose throat bobbed like an apple on a string as he gulped,
Arguin'? Who's arguin', old chap? Merely a bit of humorous banter twixt my erstwhile companion and me good self, what? I say, Berg, hadn't we better get these sea-going types aboard the good vessel Arf ship? They look jolly hungry and tired to me. We could fricassee a shark or two for friend Fulgrim, or maybe he'd prefer just to gnaw on the mess-deck table. Ah-ha-ha! Follow me, chaps! No offense, Mr. Fulgrim, sir. Merely a jocular jest, what?
Berg and Beau led them through a perfectly round tunnel in the rock. They emerged on the other side amid the mast pinnacles and stood gazing up in open-mouthed awe at the sight that greeted them. Beau managed to make an elegant leg and bowed slightly.
Welcome to the vessel Arf ship!
Jammed between the column they stood upon and the one immediately next to it was half a ship. High overhead it stood, lodged between both pinnacles, more than two-thirds of the way up. From midships to forward end it was wedged firmly, a huge, rusting iron spike at its forepeak driven into the rock by some tremendous force. The thing had once been red, but now, through seasons of harsh weather, sea spray, sun, and rain, it was faded to a rose-pink hue. Denny's voice cut the silence.
Well, fill my tunnel. Arf a ship up in the air.
Ascending another rope ladder, they climbed up to the old habitation. Trimp stared about in astonishment at the immensity of it all. It was like being in some great chamber. Timbered bulkheads with holes for oar ports let in the light, as did the opened hatch covers high above them. Fermo's voice echoed spectrally in the vast space as the crew of the Honeysuckle walked through it wide-eyed.
"And this is supposed to be only Arf a ship. I tell you, mates, could you imagine it afore it was broken, with the other Arf attached? It must have been like a floating village.
I wager there wasn't anything that size ever sailed the seas.
Verg nodded his old head.
Oh, but there was. And this is what's left of it. See through those open hatch covers? There's another deck above this and another one above that again. You're looking through three decks up to the main one, which, if you count it, makes four altogether. We keeps the hatches open to give light, battens them down in bad weather. Up these stairs is the forward cabins. Come on, I'll show ye.
Martin shook his head as he passed rows of benches with chains dangling from them and long broken oars hanging through the ports. They looked well worn from constant use. Bo, was this a slave ship?
Indeed it was, old lad. The foulest, most evil vessel that ever plied the ocean. Now 'tis our home, our beloved ARF ship. Actually, 'twould have been half ship if I'd had me way, but the others called it ARF ship, so ARF ship it is, what? Come and eat now. Questions later, that's the drill.
Following him up the ornately carved staircase, they entered a roomy cabin with its skylights thrown open. It was a complete living area. Tables, chairs, bunks, and cupboards were all about, clean and neat. Two mice, old and gray, were working at a table next to a big glowing stove with its smoke pipe thrusting through the edge of the skylight. Verg introduced them.
This is all of us left from those who sailed off long ago from the North Shores. Myself, Doolam, and Denno.
The mouse called Denno went straight to Martin and took the warrior's face gently in both his flower-dusted paws.
No need to tell old Denno who you are. I know. Luke's son Martin. Couldn't be no other beast. You're the spittin' image of the great Luke, though you got your mother saint as eyes.
Martin shook visibly, blinking hard.
You knew my mother?
Denno nodded.
Course I did. And a prettier, more gentle creature there never was. I do 'em all, Martin, every beast. But we've got all night to talk of that. Sit and rest now. The food will be ready soon.
Barnacle casserole was a delicious concoction of sea vegetables and shellfish. Guasim cooks hurried back to the honeysuckle and brought up more supplies. Beau relented, and aided by Fulgrim and Trimp, he began mixing a big plum pudding. Gonf helped the Guasim cooks to bake scones and bread. Martin and Chugger cut up an excellent cheese, studded with beech mast and hazelnuts. Denny put together a salad with any spare vegetables he rooted out. Mint tea was put on to boil, and dandelion and burdock cordial poured from a keg into serving jugs. After the tables were pushed together and set, they sat down. Gonf proposed a toast.
To the end of a journey, to my best friend Martin the Warrior, and to the wonderful victuals and good hospitality showed to us by the crew of the ARF ship.
Every beast raised their beakers and drank cheerfully. As they ate, Fermo could not resist asking the question that was puzzling him greatly.
Tell me, Verg, how did the forward half of a great ship land up here? It just don't seem possible.
Verg munched shrew bread and cheese as he explained.
You're right, mate. I wouldn't have believed it myself if and I hadn't been aboard at the time, but here's how it came about. During the biggest storm any beast had ever seen, the Goreleech, for that was once what this ship was called, struck that big rock pillar out in front. I tell you, waves twice as high as this vessel were running on a sea driven by wind and rain. 'Twas more like a hurricane than a gale. Well, she whacked that big rock side on with a force you couldn't imagine. Smashed the Goreleech clean in two, like an ought knife going through butter. On board, the forward part were oar slaves and sea rogues doing battle. We were flung to the decks like wet leaves in a wind. There was screaming, shouting, and weeping. Every beast was sure they'd met their deaths. The stern half fell backward into the sea and sank in the blink of an eye. Now the same great wave that sank it carried us and the other half swirling round to the back of the big rock.
Down, down we went as the wave ebbed away in a torrent of sucking and whirling, and we thought we were surely done for. Then another giant wave rounded the rock and lifted us, easy as a paw lifts a grain of sand. Up we rose, up, up, high in the air. From where I lay on the deck, I saw the two pinnacles as the wave crest flung us forward. Suddenly, a shuddering shock ran through me from tail to ear tips. Then everything went still. I opened me eyes and stood up. We were wedged fast right up here, the broken midships resting flat on a ledge of one column, the prow on another, with a big iron spike that stuck out front, driven like a nail deep into the rock.
Gaunt forgot the beaker which was halfway to his lips and sat shaking his head.
"And what happened next, Berg?"
The old mouse chuckled as he speared a scone with his knife.
"Me and Beau rallied our fighters fast and finished off those scummy sea rogues afore they had a chance to get us. We've lived here ever since. Nothing'll shift the old ARF ship. She's weathered time and tides, storm and seasons, aye, and never budged a splinter. After a while, we made a rope cradle and rigged the line over to the cliffs on shore. Many creatures left and went off to find their old homes. A score of us stayed here. But that was long ago. Now there's only Doolum, Deno, me and Beau left out of them all. Most of our mates died. They're wrapped in sailcloth, weighted down with stones, sleeping on the seabed far below us. Fates be kind to their memories."
Martin decided that the time had come.
"Tell me, Berg, what became of my father, Luke the Warrior?"
Beau rose stiffly and went to a cupboard. He returned to the table with a large, dusty volume.
"'Tis all within these pages, Martin. Everything, as best as the four of us can recall. We spent many a winter and autumn night recording the entire tale. It was a joint work. You know, I thought it might be found by some beast long after we were gone. But fate and fortunes have smiled on us, laddie buck. There's food and drink on the table, and a long night ahead of us, what? Here, Deno, you young whippersnapper, you can understand your own writing best. Read the journal to our friends. There's a good chap."
Deno polished a tiny pair of glasses. Perching them on his nose, he looked over at Martin.
"I was the scribe, you see. Right, let's start at the beginning. I hope you like the title. 'Tis called In the Wake of the Red Ship, this being an account of Luke the Warrior, written by his friends."
Outside, the eternal seas washed against tall rocks, and breezes sighed a wistful dirge about the basalt columns where seabirds wheeled and called. In the cabin, high among the pinnacles, Martin of Redwall listened as the saga of his father, Luke the Warrior, unfolded. Book 2. Luke. 17. There were other mice in the tribe, older and more experienced, younger mice also, bigger and stronger. But every beast regarded Luke as their natural leader. As mice go, he was nothing special to look upon, of average height and stocky build. However, on closer observation, it became obvious that Luke was a warrior born. Behind his calm, dark eyes, there lurked a flame. His stance bespoke fearlessness, some indefinable quality in his whole attitude marked him as one in whom others could put their unquestioning trust. A mouse tribe could look to him for guidance, and he could always be counted on for fairness and wisdom in his decisions. Such a creature was Luke the Warrior. Over many seasons, the tribe had wandered under his leadership. Long ago, they had left the warm areas of abundance, those places where verminous villains preyed upon any who sought the peaceful life. Constant warfare against outnumbering odds had forced Luke's tribe into the nomadic way, always seeking and searching for some place where they would not have to sleep paw on sword, with one eye open. From the fertile middle lands, they roamed north, where the weather was cold and the land bleak and sparse. On the day they reached the Northland coast, Luke thrust his sword into the earth. This would be his tribe's new home. It was a lonely place, quiet and undisturbed. The tribe approved Luke's decision. Hard-working beasts could wrest a living from the ground here, providing they were left in peace to do so. There were caves in the base of the cliffs which backed the shore, a high rocky cape thrusting out into the sea at the southern point. It felt safe, with cliffs at the back and the seas in front of them. There was good soil on the cliff tops, which could be planted and farmed in spring, summer, and autumn. For the first few days, they kept a low profile, living off what supplies they had stored, making the caves habitable. During this time, Luke and his friends patrolled the area, watching out for enemies, robber bands, and vermin raiders. Luke knew that his tribe was only a small one, wearied by constant travel, and would not be able to resist any major attack from a large force. But happily, there was neither sight nor trace of foe beast. Then, on the fourth day, Luke strode ahead of the rest as they made their way back to the caves. His step was light, and a shudder of joy ran through him. He felt that this forsaken Northland coast was already bringing him happiness. Only 2 days before, his wife Sena had given birth to their first little one, a son. They would call the new baby mouse by the name of Martin. Luke's grandsire had been named Martin, and when he was young, Luke had often listened to tales that were told of the formidable warrior mouse. It was his sword that Luke carried in the sheath on his back, given to him by his own father. Luke was the third of his family to carry the old battle blade, and one day, when the time was right, little Martin would be the next. The tribe was busy preparing a feast for Luke and Sena's son, the first little one to be born on the Northland coast. There was to be a great bonfire, too. As Luke came within sight of the caves, he could see the ever-growing mound of driftwood and dead timber being piled above the tide line. Two young mice were struggling to drag a big chunk of driftwood along the shore. Luke approached them, a smile hovering on his face at their efforts. "Well, well, Timbalisto and Fripple, when do you plan on getting that log to the bonfire pile? Next season?" Both mice were little better than 3 seasons old. They sat down wearily on the log, big round eyes imploring Luke.
"Stew blinkin' big for us, Luke. Will you lend a paw?"
The warrior mouse drew his ancient battle sword from its sheath on his back and swung it high overhead, bringing the sharp blade down to bite deep into the wood.
"Righto, you two rascals, grab a hold of the sword hilt with me. We'll see if it moves any easier with us three strong beasts pulling it. Come on!"
Heaving energetically, Luke tugged the lump of wood through the sand. He watched fondly as the two little mice pulled valiantly, each latched onto the cross-hilt. When they brought the log to the pile of timber, Luke allowed Fripple and Timbalisto to help him loose the sword blade, though he could have easily done it alone. He passed a paw across his brow, winking at them.
"Phew! Thank you, mates. 'Twas a job well done."
The little mouse maid Fripple took hold of Luke's paw.
"Please, Luke, will you take me to your cave to see your new baby, Martin? Please, Luke?"
Luke could not help chuckling at the beseeching look on Fripple's face. He tweaked her paw gently.
"Of course I will, pretty one. What about you, Timble?"
Timbalisto scowled fiercely.
"I'll stay here and guard our wood till you get back."
Martin's cradle was a hollowed-out log, lined with soft moss and a woven blanket. The only family Luke had left in the world sat by it, his wife Sena and her mother Windred. Crowing with delight, Fripple leaned over the cradle and took the baby's paw in hers.
"Oh, my, my, isn't he a lovely little feller?"
Sena held the mousemaid's smock, lest she fall into the cradle.
"Aye, he's a good baby, no trouble at all. I think he will grow bigger and stronger than his daddy."
Martin's eyes watched solemnly as his father loomed over him. He raised a tiny paw, reaching for the hilt protruding over his father's shoulder. This delighted Luke.
Ho-ho! Look at this bucko, trying to draw my sword!
Windrid hovered around the cradle anxiously.
Be careful. He might cut himself on that blade.
Luke reassured the fussing old mousewife. Oh, no, he won't. Martin's a warrior born. I feel it. Let my son hold the sword. It'll be his one day.
Sano watched her serious-faced babe trying to wrap his little paws around the black-bound haft with its redstone pommel. She shivered slightly.
May the fates forbid that he'll ever have to use it in war.
Luke released Martin's hold and stood up straight. Don't worry, Sana. That'll never happen while I'm around. Besides, I don't think we'll be bothered here, being this far north. We searched the shores and cliffs both ways. There's nothing much to the south. And if you go farther north, there's only some great tall rocks sticking up out of the sea about 3 days from here. Not a paw print of vermin anywhere. Now, what about our son's feast?
Windrid turned to the cave entrance. Out on the shore, the mice of the tribe were setting out what food they had foraged by the unlit bonfire. Each had brought what they could afford to spare, but it was not much. Windrid spoke.
Ha! Feast, you say? 'Tis a wonder we keep fur around bone on this forsaken coast. You've brought us to a cold and hungry place, Luke.
Sana checked Windrid reprovingly. That's not fair, Mother. 'Tis not Luke's fault. Where the food was plentiful, so were our enemies. At least we have safety up here, and when spring comes, we'll be able to farm and plant the clifftop lands. Luke says there's good soil up there. What about those berries old Tula saw yesterday?
Luke glanced from one to the other.
What berries? Where did Tula see them?
Sana explained.
He took a walk last evening north along the shore and said he saw lots of berries growing in a rift near the cliff top. But there were great seabirds up there, too, nesting. I thought it might be dangerous, which is why I didn't mention it yesterday. Seabirds can be very fierce creatures.
Luke patted his sword hilt.
Aye, and so am I when our tribe needs food. Leave it to me. I'll take some good, well-armed fighters with me, and Tula can show us the spot. We won't harm the seabirds if they don't attack us, and I don't think they will. For what need have they of berries? Seabirds live on what they can scavenge from the sea and the tide line. We'll gather the fruit and uproot a few young bushes to plant on the clifftops back here. Now, there's no cause for worry or fuss. I'll leave some warriors back here to guard our camp, and I'll be back as soon as I can with whatever we find up there. Carry on with the feast. The youngsters are expecting it. I'll try to return before it is finished.
Sana placed Luke's warm cloak about his shoulders.
You'll need this. It gets cold out there at night. Bring me back a little blackberry bramble, and I'll plant it so that Martin will be able to help me pick the berries in a few seasons.
Windrid adjusted the cloak around Luke's sword.
Aye, and be careful out there. This is still strange country to us, Luke.
With a score and a half of good mice that he could depend upon, Luke set out north along the shore. However, they could only travel as fast as old Tula, and the ancient mouse hobbled along at a slow, creaky gait. It was close to midnight when the foraging party reached the high crag where the berries grew. Tula sat down wearily upon the sand, pointing upward.
That's the place, Luke. But I ain't going up there. Some of those seabirds are big as eagles.
Luke took off his cloak and wrapped it around the old fella. You did well getting us this far, Tula. Stay here and rest. We'll go up. Verg, Denno, bring those ropes. By those who knew the coasts and high seas, one name was whispered with terror and loathing. Vilu Daskar. The pirate's stoat was known by other names. Butcher, thief, torturer, murderer. But none more frightening than his own. Vilu Daskar. Captain of the biggest vessel ever to plow the main. A trireme with three banks of oars pulled by wretched slaves. Crimson red. From the pennants, fluttering at its forepeaks, down through the four mighty sails to its gigantic keel, always leaving behind it a thin red wake from the dyes which oozed out of its timbers. Jutting out from the prow stood an immense iron spike, rusted red by long seasons of salt water. Such was the red ship, named the Gorleach by its master, Vilu Daskar. Evil was his trade, the red ship his floating fortress. Aboard it, he could disappear into the trackless wastes of seas and ocean, materializing again to prey on the unwary. Coastal settlements, inland hamlets, even the island havens of other sea raiders and corsairs. None were safe from the Gorleach and its bloodthirsty crew, a mob of wild, cruel vermin. Mercenaries, assassins, cutthroats, the flotsam and jetsam of earth and waters. These sea rogues were ruled by two things alone, a lust for plunder and slaughter, and a blood-chilling fear of their lord, Vilu Daskar. He reveled in the dread his name instilled into all. In the tween decks of the Gorleach, relentless drums pounded incessantly. Chained to the oars, masses of gaunt slaves bent their backs and pulled, straightening with a joint groan as they heaved on the long wooden sweeps. To the accompaniment of slave drivers, cracking their whips, and the ever-present drumbeat, the red ship sailed into the waters off North Coast. Vilu Daskar leaned against the stern gallery rail, his alert, dark eyes watching constantly, like a snake about to strike. Unlike other sea-going vermin, he was highly intelligent, well-spoken, and modestly garbed. He wore a long red cloak, beneath which was a plain black tunic, belted by a broad red calico sash, through which was thrust a long, bone-handled scimitar. The only concession to finery was his headgear, a white silken scarf bound about his brow, atop of which he wore a rounded silver helmet with a spike at its center. Tall and sinewy, he cut a quietly elegant figure, unlike the crew under his command, all arrayed in a jumble of tattered finery and sporting heavy tattoos and masses of gaudy earrings, necklets, and bracelets. Evening light was fading fast over the cold seas when, from high on the mainmast, a sea rat called Grig sang out from the crow's nest, "Land away! Off larboard, Captain! I sees a light on shore, sire, to the north of that rocky point." Vilu flicked his eyes in the direction given, without moving his body. Akla, the ferret steers beast, held the ship's wheel steady, awaiting his captain's command. Even if it meant running the Gorleach onto rocks, he knew better than to change course without Vilu's order. The stoat spoke without raising his voice. "Sweep south and take her in behind that big rock point." Two other vermin stood waiting as Vilu peered hard at the faint glow far off on the shoreline. He issued orders to them without turning, knowing they would obey instantly. "Reef and furl all sails, and increase the oar stroke to double speed. We need to get out of sight quickly." Abruptly, he strode off forward, where his bosun, the sea rat Perig, had a better view of the shore.
"So, my keen-eyed bosun, what do you see?"
Perig scratched at his beribboned whiskers, plainly bewildered.
"'Tis hard to tell, Cap'n. Oh, that's a fire right enough, and a good big un to be seen from this distance, sire."
A thin smile hovered on Vilu's lips.
"But?"
The bemused bosun shook his head.
"But any beast to be mad to light a fire that big on Northland shore. What are they up to, Cap'n?"
Vilu lost sight of the glow as the Gorleach turned south, the headland blocking his view.
"Well, no creature in their right mind would set up a signal beacon on that shore, so they are either out of their minds or ignorant of the danger. Maybe that's it, Perig. They might merely be simple beasts having some kind of celebration, eh?"
Perig's dull face broke out in a grin.
"Oh, like a kind of feast, you mean, sire?"
The stoat's paw strayed to his bone-handled scimitar.
"Quite. Not very courteous of them. The least they could have done was to invite us."
Perig's grin widened.
So we anchors the other side of yon point, comes over the rocks, and invites ourselves, eh, Cap'n?
Billu stroked the white bone scimitar hilt.
Exactly. We might not attend the feast, but the least I can do is present my calling card.
Perig stared blankly at his captain.
Calling card? What's a calling card, sire?
With lightning speed, the scimitar blade's tip was touching the bosun's throat.
This is my calling card.
Perig's throat bobbed nervously under the sharp blade tip.
Oh, I see, sire. Ha-ha!
Vilu Daskar, tired of the one-sided conversation, he put up his sword and strode off. Darkness had fallen. Luke's tribe laughed and sang around the bonfire, unaware of the big red ship anchoring on the other side of the south point. 18. Luke threw the first rope up into the darkness. A moment later, he heard the wooden bar tied to its end clack upon some rocks. He tugged it, making sure the bar held in the rocks it had wedged itself among. Paw over paw, Luke went up, whispering to Verg,
"Follow on with the other rope, mate, but be quiet. We don't want to disturb any of those seabirds."
Verg climbed up after him, and they balanced together, lodging their footpaws in the sides of the fissure. Luke took the second rope and began twirling it, paying the coils out as he swung it wider before throwing it strongly upward. This time, there was no sound of wood striking stone, but the rope went taut. A gruff, friendly voice called down in quaint speech,
"I got it, sir. I'll make ye rope first while ye climber up yer."
Verg grabbed Luke's paw in the darkness.
"Sounds like a mole to me. What do you think, Luke?"
"Aye, 'tis a mole, sure enough. Though what he's doing up a cliff, I don't know. He sounds friendly enough, anyway. Come on."
Both mice climbed until they reached a flat ledge where there were several other moles and some hedgehogs to meet them. The mole who had hailed them took tinder and flint and lit a lantern, rumbling on in his curious mole dialect.
"Brr, us'uns don't be getting mousy beasts a-clambering up to call on us, sir, but welcome to ye anyways. I be Drun Tunneler, these'uns be my family, yon Ogs be ye Tip-Tip brood, and that'n be Wealth."
A friendly-looking hedgehog wife in a broad, rough apron twitched her spikes and curtsied.
"Pleased to meet ye, I'm sure, but what be you good beasts a-doin' up here in the dark night?"
Luke introduced his party as they climbed up to the ledge. Then he explained the reason for their visit.
"We came to take some of those berries and maybe some young plants while the seabirds were sleeping, Marm. I'm sorry, though. I didn't realize they were your property."
Welf brushed the apology aside cheerfully.
"Oh, you take all the berries and shoots you need, my dearie. Rain's washed good soil into this crevice for many a season. We got raspberry, blackberry, all manner of berries growing hereabouts. Old Drun's father tunneled through to here from the cliff tops long ago. We've got a cave back there. Now don't you be afeard of the seabirds. We leaves 'em be, and they don't bother us a mite. Matter of fact, it makes good watch beasts in daytime, warns us if and sea rogues be a-coming, so we can go and hide in our cave."
Luke stared questioningly at Welf Tip-Tip.
"Sea rogues?
Oh, lackaday, sir, ain't you knowin' about those bad beasts? Why, they comes to this north coast often as not."
Luke began to feel the first stirrings of unease.
"But there's nothing to be had on Northland coast. Why do they choose to put in here?"
Drun Tunneler waved a huge digging paw.
"There be no beast you're to worry about, sir. So they'm coming to take on fresh water, patch ye sails, repair ye ships, and so forth. Brr, they'm all scum and billions."
Welf nodded agreement with her mole friend.
"So they are. We hides in our caves and stays well clear until those bad beasts are gone. Else we'd get slayed, or taken for slaves by 'em." "Oh, Luke, sir, what be the matter with ye? Do ye not feel well?"
Though the night was cold, Luke felt suddenly hot and sick.
Farther south, down the shoreline, my tribe have lit a big bonfire on the shore. We didn't think there'd be any danger this far north.
Drun's big digging claws took hold of Luke's shoulders. You must hurry, sir. Do we take your mousy beasts and giddy back with all haste? Dousey flames and put out yon fire. Et be loiky beacon to see rogues. Oi, beggy, hurry!
Welf called after the party of mice scrambling down the cliff.
Good luck go with ye, Sir Luke. We'll follow ye on in the morn with baskets of berries and whatever plants ye may need.
Aye, and Drun's moles will show ye how to hide your dwellings from the sight of sea rogues. Welf's words were lost upon Luke and his friends. They were already down and charging along the shoreline headlong, with old Twula hobbling in their wake. Dawn came wild and angry. Cold, howling, easterly gales swept the shoreline sand, piling it in buttresses against rocks and whipping grains widespread across the ebbing tide. Drun Tunneler and Welf Tip-Tip led their little band along the beach, bearing between them the promised baskets of berries and young plants. Wearing cowled cloaks and mufflers over their noses and mouths, they pressed on gallantly toward Luke's encampment, heads bowed against the weather's onslaught. To cover her anxiety, Welf chattered feverishly to her mole friend.
Now, if 'twere late spring and the weather milder, a body would expect sea rogues visiting our shores. Any beast afloat in stormy seas like we get this time of season is naught but a fool. I know 'twasn't wise for Luke and his mice to light great fires in full view on shore, but I reckon mayhap no harm will have befell him, eh, Drun?
The mole was about to agree with her when a fierce gust of sand-gritted wind caused him to turn his face seaward. He groaned aloud and dropped his basket.
Grrr, no! Look yon! 'Tis a girt red ship!
Through the fleeting spume of sand and seawater, Welf glimpsed the mighty bulk of the Gorleach, her crimson stern riding high on the main, red sails bellying tight as she sped westward out onto the deep. The good hogwife stood watching the fearful sight, tears mingling with the grit sticking to her face, and she moaned like a stricken beast.
Wow, lackaday, the red ship! Fortunes and fates a pity on those poor mice.
Drun grabbed her paw, signaling to his friends to follow.
Come on, missus, ye beast be needin' our help.
Berg was covered in swirling wood ashes from the scattered fire embers. He sat on the shore, lost in a dumb trance. Between them, Drun and Welf shouldered his paws, staring him to the meager knot of survivors who huddled forlornly in the mouth of Luke's cave. Old Twula was the only mouse who seemed able to explain what had taken place.
Friends, you come at a terrible time for us. Many graves will need to be dug in these blood-stained sands.
Welf spoke softly to the old one. Now that she had recovered from her first shock, she was all business.
Aye, 'tis so, but first we must attend to the living. Drun, will you light a fire in this cave and set water to boil? Our family will prepare food for you. Dig out any old linen you possess. We'll need bandages.
As the moles and hedgehogs took care of the shore mice, their dreadful tale came out piecemeal.
There was hundreds of them. We didn't stand a chance. It was a massacre. Only those out looking for firewood escaped. We could do nothing to stop those evil killers.
Windrid was lucky. She ran out on the shore with the babe, stumbled and fell. Her cloak was over them both, and the wind covered it with sand and hid them. 'Tis a wonder little Martin wasn't smothered.
Windrid sat by the fire, washing sand from the babe's face with warm water in the hem of her dress.
Aye, and he never made a single sound the whole time.
Poor little mite, they slew his mother.
Scum they are. I'll remember that un's name to my dying day. Vilu Daskar. She tried to fight him off with a stick, but he had a big curved blade.
He was shouting his own name, Vilu Daskar, and enjoying what he was doing. That stoat was laughing as he cut my daughter down, laughing like a mad beast.
Drun looked up from a wound he was attending to.
Ye Meister of Red Ship shows mercy to no beast, Marm. Yer, but where be Zer Luke gone to?
The young mouse Timbalisto, who had survived by climbing the cliff face, nodded toward the sea.
Luke's out there, but no beast can come near him, sir.
Waist deep in the sea stood Luke, buffeted by the cold waves, with ice forming on his tear-stained features as he gazed westerly after the red ship, which was now naught but a blurred dot far out by the horizon. Tula shook his head sadly.
He will not even look upon his own son or his wife's mother. Alas, he has no ship to sail after the murderers.
But he would have ended up slain if he did. Either way, I think Luke will die and be swept away when the tide turns. His life has been destroyed, and he cannot exact a warrior's vengeance upon the sea rogues. Luke has no will to live.
Welf hitched up her apron decisively. She turned from the sight of the forlorn creature standing in the sea to those who stood watching.
I ain't having this. By the paws and prickles, I ain't.
You there, Cardo, go and fetch a stout rope. Verg, give that stave you carry to Drun. That little mouse babe's not growing up without a father. Tula, get every able-bodied beast out here. Move! Galvanized into action by Welf's no-nonsense manner, they dispersed quickly to their allotted tasks. Drun Tunneler tied the rope end around his middle and gripped Verg's stave tight.
I never was one for paddling in the sea, Marm.
The hogwife eyed him sternly. She was not about to be disobeyed in any circumstances.
Go to it, Drun, before Luke freezes to death.
The mole trundled dutifully into the sea.
"'Tis a good job, oi trusters, he misses."
Luke was totally unaware of the mole wading up behind him, his eyes fixed on the horizon where the Gorleach had disappeared from sight. Drun heaved an unhappy sigh.
"'Whrr, oi hates to do this, Zer Luke, but 'tis for thy own good, and furry hinfant too, brr I."
With one blow of the stout beech stave, he knocked Luke unconscious. Looping the rope about Luke so that they were bound together, Drun called back to the watchers on shore.
"You heave away, Forrest. I'm most colded to death out yer."
Willing Paws pulled the rope swiftly into dry land. The days that followed were hard upon the survivors. They buried their dead and would have gone on mourning all season, but for the help of the moles and the hedgehogs. Welf chided them ruthlessly, and Drun bullied them cheerfully, until they began to pick up the pieces and get on with the business of living. Luke recovered, but he spoke to none, sitting silently at the back of his cave, gazing into the fire. Every once in a while, he would wander out into the night, and then sleepers would be awakened by his roaring down at the water's edge, shouting one name.
Vilu Daskar! Vilu Daskar! Vilu Daskar!
The morning following one such night, Luke's cave had become the meeting place for every beast. They were gathered around the fire, breakfasting on hot oat cakes and blackberry preserve. Welf brewed a big pot of mint and comfrey tea, which they sipped as they ate. Luke had returned from the sea's edge, and he lay on a rocky ledge, wrapped in his cloak, sleeping. Cardo had a flat driftwood board, and his knife was heating in the flames as he announced to the gathering, "I'm going to burn the names of our lost ones onto this wood with my knife point. Don't let me forget any beast. I'll fix it in the sand on top of the big grave. Agreed?" Young Timbalisto sniffed and rubbed a paw at his eyes.
"Will you put Fripple's name on it, sir?"
Cardo took his blade from the fire. He smiled sadly. "Of course I will, Timbal. How could I forget my own daughter?
I'll put a little flower after it. She'd like that. To break the atmosphere, Welf turned their attention to the baby Martin.
Deary me, will you look at that mite? He's out of his cradle again. Where's he a-crawling to now?
Windred knew.
He's after his father's sword again. Watch.
The solemn, chubby mouse babe crawled over until he could get his paw on Luke's sword hilt. He sat quietly enough, trying to lift the weapon, which was twice his height.
Drun squinted his eyes admiringly at the babe's efforts.
Ye vermints beware when that one grows.
Windred looked across to Martin's sleeping father.
Aye, and bad fortune to any sea rogues when Luke awakens properly. He will, you mark my words. I know him.
19. In the seasons that followed, Luke and his surviving tribe did well and learned many things. No longer were they hungry, farming the cliff-top land, foraging farther afield in good weather, and gathering mollusks, shrimp, and shellfish from rock pools and tide shallows. Drun and his moles taught them how to create screens of rock, driftwood, and overhanging vegetation for their caves, disguising them from the gaze of unwanted visitors and providing windbreaks against harsh weather. Windred looked after little Martin, who had become a sturdy toddler, living the simple life, still as solemn and well-behaved as ever. Luke, however, was a different creature from the easy-going, good-humored leader he had been before his wife's death. His tribe learned to give him a wide berth and ask no questions of him. He kept a cave apart from the others, in which he was making and storing weapons. He came and went at odd times, returning with materials he had gathered in his wandering. Martin was the only one he would confide in, though he constantly questioned Drun and Welf on the habits of sea rogues. How often did they visit the north coast? Did they ride at anchor or beach their vessels? What sort of discipline did they employ? What was the average size of a crew? What type of weapons and tactics did they favor? If a ship was sighted out on the main, all creatures ran for cover. But Luke would lie on the clifftops with Martin, watching it. The little fellow listened carefully to what his father had to say.
I hope that vessel doesn't put in here, son. I'm not ready for them yet. Better that it stays out to sea and sails off. But when I'm ready, the day will arrive when I'll be looking for a ship to land here, and then we'll see what the sea scum are made of. Look, she's veering off southward. We won't be bothered by that one, thank fortune. Come on, you can help me to build up our weapon supply.
Luke showed his son how to make arrows, while he himself attended to the bows.
See these? They're ash branches, good heavy wood. I've chosen the ones that are medium thick and straight, and dried the ends out by standing them in warm sand around the fire. Now, we make a slit in the opposite end and fit a piece of feather in it, like so, then bind above and below the feather with twine. Next, I place the dried end of the wood in the fire, let it burn, but not too much. Then rub it to a point on this rock. Burn a little more, rub a little more. Here, Martin. Try the end of this with your paw. Be careful.
Martin dabbed his paw gently on the needle-like point his father had rubbed onto the fire-darkened ash. He smiled.
Ooh, it's shark.
Luke smiled at his little son, who was still learning to pronounce words.
Aye, 'tis shark all right, very shark. Sea vermin don't wear armor, so an arrow doesn't need a metal or flint tip. A good, hefty ash shaft with a fire point will stop him.
Berg entered the cave and indicated Martin with a nod.
His grandma Windred is looking for him. Dinner's ready in the big cave. Are you coming, Luke?
Luke glanced up from the bowstring he was twining and greasing.
I'll be along. There's still work to do here.
Berg looked around at the rows of stakes waiting to be sharpened, flint axe heads, unstrung yew bows, and gnarled driftwood limbs waiting to be fashioned into clubs.
A fair old bit of work, I'd say, Luke. Why don't me and Cardo and some of the others help you?
Luke nodded off the end of his finished bowstring.
My son's a good little helper, but I could do with some like you to lend a paw. Why didn't you offer sooner, Verg? His friend smiled dryly. Because none of us fancied getting our heads bitten off. Luke offered his paw. Sorry, mate. I accept your help gratefully. It's not your heads I'm looking to bite off, just the sea rogues.
Verg took Luke's paw and shook it warmly.
Good. Let's go and get some dinner. Then every able-bodied beast in camp will pitch in with pleasure.
From then on, Luke became a real warrior chieftain, directing his creatures in the making of weaponry, drilling and training his fighters, and marking off the shoreline around the caves in various strategies and plans for when the time was ripe. It came unexpectedly, one evening the following summer. Having finished their day's chores, the tribe sat about after dinner in the big cave mouth, their backs warmed by the fire within, enjoying the pleasant evening. Windred was singing an old song which had been passed down through her family.
Old Ninny and Mouse and his good wife needed a house to build. They had a family grown so large, their tent was overfilled. To setting sun the old wife toiled, from daybreak in the east, but Ninian was a lazy mouse, who loved to sleep and feast. The wife heaved stone and carried wood, for door and wall and beam, while Ninian, idly in daylight, snored on in peaceful dream. She raised the gables, built a roof, her back was bent and sore, as Ninian ate up all the food and loudly called for more. So when the house at last was built, his wife nailed up a sign, which stated, "This ain't Ninian's," she said, "that shows 'tis mine." Then when the countless seasons passed, and all within had died, the rain and storm of ages long had swept the sign outside. It washed the first three letters out, but left the rest intact. That sign now reads, St. Ninian's. A church? A joke? A fact. So, traveler, if you read the sign, then take my word 'tis true. A dreamer can become a saint. So can a glutton, too.
Welf applauded with the rest, chuckling and shaking her head at Windred's song.
Tell me, Windred, my dear, is it true? Is there such a place as St. Ninian's, or is it really a joke?
Luke answered for her. 'Tis a fact, Marm. I was born at St. Ninian's, as was Sena, my poor dear wife. We were driven out when I was a babe by an evil warlord, a wild cat named Lord Greeneye Verdaga, who had a horde of vermin at his command, so they told me, but I was far too young to remember. This is our home now, and no beast will ever drive us from here while I am about.
Drun Tunneler dashed toward them, waving. He was panting hard, having clambered down from the cliff tops.
Brr, giddy inside, good beasts all, ye sea rogue ship be a-comin' yer.
Immediately the tribe began pulling out driftwood and vegetation to disguise the cave's entrance as they had been shown. Luke nodded to Verg and Doolum to accompany him down to the tide line. Shading their eyes against the westering sun, the three mice stood in the ebbing tide shallows watching the ship. Verg scratched his head and looked to Luke.
"Doesn't look quite right to me, mate. What do you make of it?"
Luke scrutinized the vessel keenly. It was still a good distance from land.
Could be just an honest merchant trader. But in these waters, I doubt it, Verg. It doesn't seem to be making good headway. If it's trying for land, it won't make it here until near daybreak tomorrow, at the rate 'tis going, eh, Doolum?
Doolum watched the strange craft take a north tack, as if trying to catch the wind. He pointed.
See? She's got a broken mast, I think. That's why the going's so hard for that ship.
Luke checked Doolum's sighting.
You're right, mate. Maybe this is just what we've been waiting for. Back to the cave and rouse our fighters.
Reynard Chopsnout,
captain of the vessel Greenhawk, was in high bad humor. His ship was taking on water, and to make matters worse, had a broken mainmast and 10 days on short rations. Moreover, the crew were becoming mutinous, and he was hard-pressed to maintain command. The Corsair Fox pawed irritably at the hard, polished blob of pitch which served him as a snout. It was stuck on where his nose had been until he came off worse in a sword fight with a skillful ferret. Chopsnout roared at the hapless weasel who was wrestling with the tiller.
"Hold her fast to the wind, boot brain! What's the matter with you? To the wind, I said, waggle paw! The wind!"
Some of the vermin crew were aloft, trying to rig a jury mast. One of them called down mockingly,
"Don't shout too hard, Choppy! Your nose'll fall off!"
Chopsnout grabbed a belaying pin and hurled it up at the rigging. It fell back, almost hitting him. Amid the hoots and jeers of the crew, he yelled,
"Who said that? Come on, own up, you lily-livered poltroon!"
Another insult rang out from below, where other crew members were bailing out the water the Greenhawk was shipping.
"Bootbrain would handle the tiller better if your fed is proper, you old victual robber!"
Chopsnout cannot see who made the remark. He danced and stamped in anger on the deck planking.
"Liar! Filthy, foul-tongued liar! I get the same amount of victuals that every beast aboard gets!"
There was an ominous clack. Chopsnout quit stamping and dropped on all fours, scuttling about the deck. This caused great hilarity among the crew, and bold ones began yelling,
"Oops! Old Choppy's lost his hooter again, mates! Sahar!"
"Let's hope it don't bounce down here and kill some beast."
"Give him a chance, mateys. He's on the scent of it, hee-hee."
"Ar now, don't say that, bucko. He'll go and get all sniffy on us. Ho, 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 ho."
The irate fox soon found his pitch-blob nose and stuck it on hastily. He paced the deck, waggling his cutlass ominously.
"Go on, laugh, ya slab-sided slobberin' swabs, but don't come whining to me for aid or advice. I'm finished, you hear? Finished!"
He strode off huffily to his cabin. Bootbrain dithered at the tiller, not sure of which way to swing it.
"Har, come on, Cap'n! We was only funnin'. What course do you want me to set?"
Chopsnout poked his head round the cabin door and cast a withering glance at the weasel.
"Course? I couldn't give a frog's flipper what course you set. Sail where you fancy. Let the ship leak till she sinks. Leave the mainmast broken. 'Tain't my business. I'll leave the command of the Greenhawk to you clever-tongued beasts, and see how you like it."
There was an uneasy silence from the crew. Darkness was falling fast, and no beast was about to take on the responsibility of running the vessel. Chopsnout smiled triumphantly.
"So, what have you got to say to that, me fine buckos?"
Bootbrain, who was never given to teasing or insulting his captain, could not help making an observation.
"Cap'n, your nose is on the wrong ways round. You've stuck it on backward."
The final straw came when a strangled titter rang out from below. Reynard Chopsnout slammed his cabin door shut and sat sulking in his cabin. Sometime after midnight, there was a rap on the cabin door. Chopsnout snarled at the beast without.
"Go away and leave me alone."
The rapping persisted, accompanied by a voice.
"But, Cap'n, listen. 'Tis your old mate Flogtail. I've spotted something on the shore. Come and look."
Adopting a stern face, Chopsnout emerged from his cabin. The crew were gathered on deck, peering at a fire burning on the beach, some distance away. The Corsair Fox could not help smirking as he addressed Flogtail, the sea rat first mate.
"Well, well, a fire, eh? Looks no different from any other I've seen. What do you plan on doing about it, mate?"
Flogtail stared hard at the firelight, scratching his fat stomach distractedly.
"Scritchy and Whipback reckons we oughter tack a bit and sail beyond that point, sticking up southards, Cap'n."
Chopsnout smiled encouragingly at the two sea rats.
Clever thinking, you two. What next?
Both sea rats hastily explained their plan.
We dropped anchor to other side of the point, Cap'n. Aye, then, we climbs over that point and drops in on 'em. That's right. Then we slaughters 'em all and robs any victuals we find.
Chopsnout shook his head in despair at their stupidity.
How do ye know that those creatures on shore ain't already sighted us and armed theirselves up, eh? And tell me this, what's to stop this ship sinking if and you takes the time to tack around behind yonder point? Well, come on. I'm waiting for an answer off in some bright spark.
There followed a deal of paw shuffling and blank looks. Then Flogtail appealed sheepishly to Chopsnout.
Cap'n, how would you go about it, sir?
Chopsnout snorted airily.
Oh, you're in trouble now, so you's need your old cap'n again, eh? Well, I ain't making a move till I gets a full apology off in this crew for the insults I've bore.
Staring at the deck, as if the answer lay there, the vermin crew mumbled disjointedly.
Sorry, cap'n, about your no.
About what we said to yer.
Aye, we didn't mean it, cap'n.
"'Twas only a joke, Cap'n. We won't say nothing no more. You're the best cap'n ever to sail the seas, sir.'
Chopsnout attempted a sniff, holding onto his nose, which was starting to wobble slightly.
"'Well, all right. So be it. But next time you start any of that, I'm done with you for good. Now here's the way I sees it. That fire on shore is only a little, and all I can see is two beasts sitting by it, mouses maybe.' If and there was a full tribe of them, there'd be a great big fire. So I figures there's only the pair of them, probably some old hermit and his wife. They're either daft or blind because they ain't seen us, or they wouldn't have lighted a fire and give themselves away. Hark to me now, this is my plan. Leave off fixing the mast and bailing out water, all four paws on deck, cause the tide's starting to ebb. Grab any spare planks, timbers, or oars, and start paddling her for the shore, double quick. We'll run the Greenhawk up on the sand and beat her high and dry. Then we'll capture those two mice and torture them till we finds out where they've hid all their victuals.
End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.